I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
The rise of the internet has allowed us to connect and exchange in new and interesting ways. And now, with the birth of decentralized platforms like blockchain, we're seeing new possibilities open up for people, not just in the world of cryptocurrency, but as a way to securely share data and knowledge of all kinds.
In this episode, we are speaking with Michel Bouwens, a Belgian researcher and founder of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. His work focuses on the capacity of peer-to-peer theory to enable the growth of our knowledge commons, where new protocols for living equitably and ecologically can go viral. We'll let him explain.
So my name is Michel Bouwens. I'm a Belgian. I'm 63. I have four children. And I live in Chiang Mai in the north of Thailand. And so I'm also the founder of the Peer-to-Peer Foundation. And so what we do is we promote two different things. One is what we call peer-to-peer, and the second we call the commons. And maybe I'll start by explaining what we mean, right? So peer-to-peer, I think a lot of people are familiar with it now. It's a word that was originally used in computing to show a network form where computers can talk directly to each other without passing through a server. And the only thing that I did is actually just adding one more interpretation is, if that goes for computers, it goes for people as well. And what that means is that once we have these kinds of computer infrastructures, which was the original infrastructure of the internet, that also means that people can connect to each other globally, right? And this is something new. So if you look at human history, you could say that we started in small clans and tribes and family bands. But as soon as we wanted to kind of scale, we needed authority and centralization and, you know, command structures. And suddenly now we have things like the Linux operating system, or something called Arduino, which is a motherboard for the computer, and the Wikipedia. And what you see is that these systems are open collaborative systems. So they're networks of thousands of people, hundreds of companies, and not a single entity is commanding anybody else in the system, but they do have to coordinate. And so what it means is that we're really changing, you know, human organization from a system that was exclusively based on territories, you know, people living together in a geography and creating villages and cities and nation states, to now a very powerful form of digital self-organization. Right. And so what we study is how these two things interact. And so you have, let's say, the local, but now you have the translocal. You have the international, now you have the transnational. And these two worlds or aspects of the world will have to somehow, you know, learn to live with each other. And sometimes there's tension, sometimes it's complementary. Sometimes one wants to replace the other. And so this is, you know, the same thing that happened in the 16th century with the invention of the printing press, where suddenly the way that information knowledge was, you know, distributed changed. And so the Catholic Church lost its control over the, you know, the religious ideology, and it started splintering. And then you had, you know, three centuries of civil war. So that's the kind of thing we're looking at, right? We're looking at a very deep change in civilization. Now I want to explain the second concept, which is the commons. So most people, and especially I think in the US, they always think is, well it's either is it a market or it's the state. And actually in industrial civilization, that's what we did, you know, for 200 years. So you have some people saying, let's say the progressives, that, you know, the market needs to be embedded in society and the government has to make sure that there are rules and regulations. And then the other side would say, no, we need more freedom. You know, we don't need all these regulations. The more regulations, the worse. And so this is a recurring debate in our societies that, you know, with some polarity changes every 30 years, but basically the same debate. And so what I'm saying, what we are saying, is there's actually a third institution that has been crucial in human history, and that's called the commons. Now, what is it? It's basically a shared resource that is managed by a group of people or stakeholders, but crucially, that can manage itself through its own rulemaking. So it's not a state and it's not a market. States and markets are by nature more degradative. They actually degrade the environment. So they create more wealth for humans, and especially for the elites that are running the societies, but at the cost of the environment. But if you're a local person in a village, what you want is to maintain your capacity to create a livelihood for you and your descendants for the next seven generations. So you have a different mentality. So the commons historically has been the only human institution capable of, you know, the long-term management of ecological resources. And now we have a global planetary crisis. And what peer-to-peer allows us to do is, first of all, to create knowledge commons, right? To say we can solve issues by combining our collective intelligence, and we can organize around that knowledge. Yeah, and that gives you movements like permaculture. Now, permaculture, you with your feet in the mud, you're connected with your community, but your head is in the networks today, right? So, we call that cosmo-local. Mm-hmm. Everything that's heavy should be more local, and everything that's light should be as global as you can, because you want to learn from everybody.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense until now.
Okay, a couple questions. First of all, with the advent of democracy, is it not the case that government essentially also has kind of become the symbol and or steward of the commons? Or is that a whole separate thing? Like when we think about tax collection and distribution of common assets.
There is a relation, but they're public goods, they're not common goods. And so it's a subtle difference. So if you look at the history of, you know, industrialization, so we have what we call the enclosures. So 16th century England and Scotland, they start dividing up the land to private owners with fences. That's why it's called enclosures. And they changed the property arrangement, because under feudalism, you know, the lord had also duties, like the village, there were his children, right? It was a patriarchal system, but the father has duties. Once you have pure private property, you can think, oh, I can make more money with sheep than with men. So I chase away the men, right? The humans. So that created this huge exodus of people from the countryside to the cities, where they became workers. So that's the privatization of the commons. So then these workers in the cities, and you have to remember, you know, early capitalism was very, very wild. So people were dying when they're like 35 years old on average. You know, those are the statistics in England in 1850 in Manchester and Birmingham and Liverpool. So what they did was they mutualized their life risk. So they created social security, right? So these were commons. These are social commons. But they only were able to do that for 20% of the population. So then the state comes in and says, we make welfare into a right for everybody, right? So what's the difference? Well, the thing is that the commons become statified, so they no longer run with their own rules of the communities. They are run by the state. So the physical commons were privatized and the social commons were statified. And then they're no longer commons. That doesn't mean they're bad. I mean, we can say that there are a lot of good things about private ownership. And we can also say there's a lot of good things about, you know, public welfare. But there's a loss of autonomy, right? Because you're delegating, if you live in a democracy, you're delegating your vote to somebody who will, you know, decide in your place, as opposed to a local community, which has lots of different ways to, you know, manage their local commons. So that's the difference.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying the commons is better for everything. What I'm saying is that if you want to preserve the web of life and natural resources, in times of increasing scarcity, the best thing to do is to mutualize the governance of these resources and then let the market play for allocation, but within the rules that's set by a commons-based institution that says, well, you know, we need to preserve copper, not just for today, but for the next, you know, generations, right? And so how we're going to do that is, that's a complicated question, but that's kind of the general idea.
So why is peer-to-peer an important part of this conversation?
Because it gives us the freedom to associate directly with one another without intermediaries, right? And there is a left-wing version and a right-wing version of this. So the left-wing version would be like, you know, we create groups and groups connect to each other. And the more individualistic right-wing version is, we're all individuals, we make smart contracts with each other over the blockchain, and we're all entrepreneurs and we connect with each other. It's a slightly different story, but both are based on the same dynamic of, you know, free association. And, you know, if you look at history, you have moments of centralization and moments of decentralization. So you have the Roman Empire, which centralized, it collapsed. Then you have the Middle Ages, it's a very distributed system. You have free cities, and you have barons and dukes. Then you have the church, weak monarchs and emperors, they're not very strong. So it's kind of very distributed system. And then we get the Renaissance and everything centralizes again, right? And I would venture that today the zeitgeist, you know, the spirit of the times, is that most people or a lot of people are losing faith in centralization. And so we're starting to dream again about distribution, meaning, you know, lots of little things that can work together rather than, you know, big nations and big corporations. You know, if you talk to blockchain people, that's what they feel, right? Let's design a system where the big banks and the state, you know, can't really control us, you know. And you kind of feel that this feeling is something that is deeper now in our societies than, say, you know, 50 years ago.
So staying at the peer-to-peer network, Michelle, how can a peer-to-peer network establish accountability?
So here's where, I mean, in small groups, you know, you can do a social charter and you know, you watch each other. But once you scale, and I think this is what the blockchain is about. So the internet is an internet of communication, but the blockchain is an internet of transactions. And everything we do, you know, when we do business, when we exchange, is represented through accounting, right? And so distributed ledgers is really about shared accounting. And what the people around the blockchain are doing is, and you know, they're mostly like individualistically oriented. They're, you know, market-oriented thinkers mostly. What they're thinking about is what kind of incentives can we build in this system so that people can work together more smoothly and making everything transparent for accountability and creating smart contracts. And so everything is actually, you know, designed to scale trust in working with people that you don't know. And I think if you look at history, that is the trust with an H, thrust of human history, right? So we start with small groups, and you trust them because it's your family. Then we have monarchs and emperors. Then we have world religions, so you can trust them because they also fear God in the same way you do. That's why you can trust them. Then we have the nation state, Big Brother, right? And now we're moving to these trans-local, trans-national infrastructures. And so I think this is realistic because I feel it has this kind of, you know, very deep well of human evolution behind it. It's not an accident that we're doing this now.
So let's move on to the commons and the trends that we see today of the destruction of the commons, whether it's from government or market. We know that ecological resources are declining. We know that we're in danger of climate change and other shifts, pandemics. What is this peer-to-peer method or trend going to be like in addressing those issues? And more specifically, could we talk about a specific example, maybe Wikipedia, but how would that be translated to preserving ecological resources?
Okay, so let's distinguish maybe the local and then the translocal level. So at the local level, what we see now is a tenfold increase in 10 years of urban commoning. So people in the cities who see that things are not working right for the moment, they want organic food, they want renewable energy. So you see a huge amount of the creation of these, you know, provisioning systems that are being more and more run around commons. So they're being mutualized. For example, everybody knows Uber, but at the same time, there's a lot of car sharing associations and co-ops as well, you know, where people are saying, so let's take a car sharing arrangement. If you do that, you can have the same amount of mileage, the same freedom of transport. If you have 10% of cars for, you know, let's say 10 cars for 100 people, right? So it's 5%, you double it, then you sure that everybody always has a car. Well, 10 cars for 100 people, that's a lot less than if everybody needs their own car, you know, to make sure they can have the car, right? So by doing that, you replace, every shared car replaces between 9 and 13 private cars. It saves 80% of the cost. And it's good for the environment. So you have a whole set of advantages in, you know, in this particular case. And you can repeat that same story. So that's why people are doing it. And it becomes very potent once you start combining it. You know, you have a housing co-op. You make an agreement with a co-op for your food. And I've met some people like in Boulder, you know, and they had an agreement. So except for the meat, they paid $5 a day, you know, for an abundance of vegetables, right? So you can be idealistic about it, but a lot of people now are becoming precarious, jobless. Then it becomes interesting to be part of the, you know, these types of solutions, to, you know, to maintain a lifestyle, to secure your food and energy. At the translocal level, well, I think what we need to do is build new types of institutions that protect the ecological commons. So you have permaculture, and you say, well, you know, there's a few in New York, maybe, or a few there, here and there, and it may not be impressive, but you look at the world scale. You know, there's 12,000 of them already in just a few years, right? So these things are maybe not so visible, but they're actually growing, you know, very fast in a very short time. So that's what the peer-to-peer is about. It's about protocols that can virally spread if they work well.
So another question pops up, which is completely beyond, you know, the spectrum we just said. But in this conversation, I think universal basic income would actually be quite an accelerator. Would you agree, or what's your stand on universal basic income?
So I don't know how realistic it is to do it, but what I see the basic income as a transition income. Right. So there's a lot of people who would like to do things, you know, follow their passionate nature. But it's too risky for them. You know, they have a mortgage and they have this and that, and so they won't do it. And I think that a basic income, you know, there would probably be a third of these people who would, you know, go to the mountains with the sheep and the goats. So a lot of things that need to happen would start happening at a much more rapid scale if we had a basic income. I'm pretty convinced of that. And so, you know, there's some in-between proposals, that, for example, something called a transition income, you know, where you would fund 10% or 20% of your population that is motivated to do transition work. And you know, if you think about the Middle Ages, you know, much poorer, you know, sometimes up to 25% of the population were monks and nuns, right? So they were able to finance a quarter of their population doing, you know, what they consider to be high quality spiritual work, right? So why couldn't we?
Yeah, there is a lot of aspects actually about the Middle Ages, I think, where you think like, not so dark at all.
It's an interesting period because it shows, you know, it was a really distributed society where you had, everything was based on contracts and privileges. And, you know, the commoners in the city, the guilds, then would make an agreement with the king. And so they would have, you know, free city charters. And every guild had its own judicial system. So they were, you know, judging their own affairs. And so it was a complicated period. But, you know, people usually think that we're freer today. And I'm not sure that's the case because, you know, now we have these nation states that basically control everything we do. That's one of the things that I discovered in Thailand is that, you know, the sets of rules is so much smaller. So if you're poor, you get you lose your job, you just get a card and you start making food in front of your house. And nobody will tell you anything. And the whole society is built to accept it. So you have, you know, the shopping malls, they have popular markets three times a week in front of the supermarket. They don't see it as a competition. So there is this whole mentality here of supporting the small informal economy, which probably means there's like 0% unemployment in this country. Maybe not now with COVID, but, you know, on average.
I was wondering if we, if there is a subject, Michel, where you are, like, which is, let's say, close to your heart, or what you're currently working on, or something you really would like to talk about, or...
I think maybe how people can engage in this conversation and maybe even bring it into their lives. And it's so many of us are very attracted to solutions that aren't privatization or governmentization, but something where we can participate, but it's not always accessible, right? I mean, even we hear about blockchain, we hear about, then you think Bitcoin. You don't think about the idea of protocol, which I think what I hear is that you can bring together a group of people around a set of principles or actually operating standards and put those into kind of digital practice and then manifest a way of preserving
commons.
That's what
people are trying to do now, right? Because they want to scale. And that's why they use a blockchain to scale. And so this is maybe an interesting thing, right? So technology is designed by people, and people have values and interests, and therefore the design of technology is influenced by this, right? So in the blockchain, you can have Bitcoin, which is very speculative. It's a commodity-based currency. It's highly unequal in its ownership. And it's energivore, right? It uses an enormous amount of energy. But you can also have mutual credit currencies. And you can have asset-based currencies. For example, you have the fish coin, which is a currency that reflects the stock of the fish. So you can only have so many fish coin, then you're allowed to fish without destroying the self, you know, their ability to self-replicate. So you have to look at that. You can't just say, you know, it's peer-to-peer. You have to look at what are the values behind the project. And so I'm, of course, you know, more looking at projects that have this built-in desire for fairness and equity. So I look at things like Common Stack. Maybe I'll tell you one example to end, which is I think it's brilliant. So this is in Kenya. It's called Sarafu. It was founded by Will Ruddick, who's an American. So you have the slums in Mombasa, and they have what's called chamas. Chamas are rotating savings and loans associations. So poor people give, you know, a bit of money every month, and then every month there's a pool of money that can go to one of the members who can then buy a phone or, you know, motorcycle, things that they couldn't do, you know, otherwise. So he has linked that to a complementary currency and has linked that complementary currency to the blockchain, right? And suddenly everything becomes transparent and they grew 600% in 6 months. And now the Red Cross, and they're saying, oh, you know, we want to help you, because they immediately see what is happening with their donations, right? So this is brilliant because it combines all the advantages of locality. It's still run by these women's groups who, you know, save money. It has jump-started the local economy because these people are moneyless. They couldn't get in the normal economy. And then it brings the scaling capacity of the blockchain and the trust of the blockchain. So this is, I think, where we have to look for these kinds of, you know, very clever complementary engineering of the local and then the advantages of not being local.
Yeah, that's a really great example because it's already embedded in society, in some societies. You know, I know in West India, and West Indian islands, they call it susu, where they rotate savings, right? And immigrants who come to America do that.
Yes, and they're very powerful. The ones who are successful are the ones who do that. You know, like the yes. Koreans and Chinese clans, they yes. have this.
Yeah, then they can buy a home or a car or some capital item. Yeah, so that's very powerful. And what you're saying is the peer-to-peer networks makes that scalable. Like what they're already doing in their neighborhood, now they can do for their whole country or the whole area, region, whatever.
And I think maybe the technical class, and you know, we have our prejudices, is that we always think build it and they will come. And we'll radically do the opposite. He went to these people, looked what they were doing, and then design a technology around it. And I think that's more powerful in the long run. You know, maybe less exciting, but then you make tech that is really close. You know, it's called value sensitive design. You know, so it's an interaction between the experts and the people, yeah. right? Yeah. Because you don't want to eliminate expertise either, right? You don't want to be completely horizontalist and not recognize expertise and give ignorant people, you know, saying how to build the bridge. That's not what you want. You want, so I sometimes call this a super competent democracy. You want the right mix. And so I'm working with groups like that. So maybe to end another example, it's called bio-urbanism, right? So they work with the pattern language of Christopher Alexander, who wrote a 3-volume book looking at, you know, what is a good village? What is a convivial community? And he concluded all these rules. And so what they're doing is they go to the slums and then they ask the people, okay, what do you want? Right? And then they can say, well, we know that this and this and this would work to go in that direction. So that's like, for me, a perfect interaction between knowledge, expertise, and inclusion and diversity at the same time.
Yeah, and we can welcome our listeners to listen to Will Ruddock and his examples, and we have an episode about what's going on in Kenya. And I love this example of the convivial community, because that's, I think, what we all aspire to, right? Is having a community that preserves the common resources, but also expands quality of life.
But in a weird way, you know, this is also where the real estate industry is all about, right? It's when you look at what is promoted, it's always this kind of everyone wants to have a good neighborhood, good community, and then real estate developers come in. I simplify it now, right? Develop and then become sort of let's say money centered, rather than people planet centered. And you know, I think that it's hard for me to sort of say, okay, yes, we point to a solution here, and then at the same time we still have a mass solution which is not quite working for getting.
But that's the market, right? So the market is incentivizing profit structure. And then these peer-to-peer commons.
You know, we need markets that work for the commons.
Right.
And so we need this kind of resilient, regenerative economy. And sometimes I call them entrepreneurial coalitions, right? You have entrepreneur, but some people say the word entrepreneur means taking in between. So I changed to entrepreneur.
I like that.
So how can I create a business that serves my community and makes it better and still create a living for me, right? Or the opposite, people involved in the commons, they can say, well, what kind of companies can we create that guarantee our livelihood, right? If you do it, that's a whole different mindset than saying, you know, how can I make the most profit from this, right? So there's a good book about it. I'm from Marjorie Kelly, I think her name is, where she talks about, you know, what is a regenerative business, and she has five criteria, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the book title right now, but it's worth looking up. Marjorie Kelly.
I think the Capital Institute also has principles of a regenerative economy.
Yeah, these are all very, so, you know, what I'm doing is not unique. It's in the zeitgeist, you know, it's in the spirit of the times. So you will feel that. So the only thing that we do that most other people don't do is that we are an observatory. And so we have a wiki, wiki.p2pfoundation.net, that has 25,000 examples in every domain, whether it's housing, transportation, food, energy. And we've been consulted 100 million times already. So it's, you know, so trying to keep the big picture, that's what I'm trying to do.
Michel, one last kind of a chicken and egg question, right? So on the one hand, we have this technology, this enabling technology that allows for the growth and scaling of peer-to-peer. But on the other hand, there's a mind shift of identity that happens, right? From this more entrepreneurial perspective as an individual to a more communal perspective and how we identify ourselves. Do you have an opinion as to how those, you know, that infrastructure versus that identity actually feed off of each other, or how to propagate that more quickly? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't think I have the magic formula, but I think that we have to guard the two extremes, right? We don't want a hyper individualistic society, but we also don't want a fully collectivist society. So we want complex individuals, you know, to feel good in their community, and to so it's kind of finding the right mix. And yeah, how to do that? That's an ongoing concern and lots of experimentations. But you know, it's like in startups, right? You have, you know, like in the startup model, you have, what is it, 1,000 startups, and then venture capital is betting on one or two of these 1,000, which, you know, will explode, right? So it's the same in the commons. It's, you know, a lot of people try things that don't work, but you have this kind of sea of experience that is growing slowly. And, you know, we know that there are things that work, like co-ops work, and community land trust work, you know, so food energy co-ops, you know, in Germany are now the norm. Like they do 60% of the energy production in Germany. So we have to look at the things that work, right? And then spread those and learn from them.
Well, yeah. We certainly wish you the best of luck, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Yeah,
it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, I loved our conversation with Michel, especially when it comes to the mass adoption of what is possible today. You know, so these, when he talks about the protocols which can go out and basically go viral, I think that's the term to be used here. And that's very exciting to me, you know, how the average person who doesn't know about, or, you know, doesn't need to know about the detail of the technology, nor all what is behind, nor need to know about the Middle Ages or historic examples, but just become a user, just participate in what is possible today.
Yeah, no, it is exciting. And I also wonder, though, what does a viral protocol actually look like? So, you know, he gave this example of cars, right, where everyone could use a car and that would save 13, share a car and that would save 13 cars. But in the back of my mind, I'm wondering, well, who's going to give up their car? You know, there is some...
You're so American, I'm sorry to say.
No, I'm actually... Maybe I am American. Of course I'm American. But I do believe that there's some people who go for it for economic reasons, but other people, there's a mind shift that's required to separate yourself from your car, your identity from your car, your comfort and your convenience from your car. And that takes something, and I'm not sure, you know, it's just a viral protocol that's going to do it. What will be the incentive or that creates that mind shift? And I'm actually interested in the mind shift that brings us to adopt these technologies and this peer-to-peer network. And some people will
but
just,
it does work hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah. Some people will just do it because it's interesting and new, or some people do it because they really want to support the commons. But a lot of people will fight against it.
And they already do.
Yeah, and they.
I mean, that's kind of why we are in this world situation currently, because if we were collaborating to basically support the good solutions, we were not seeing climate change, but yet we do.
Right, and I think part of that is the question you asked, which is about accountability. So, you know, it's pretty easy to create accountability peer-to-peer with one individual versus another. It's a very different animal to take accountability for corporations or even governments. And governments may be even a little easier than corporations. But I think we're seeing so much destruction occurring out of, you know, corporate entities that have no accountability. And where does peer-to-peer fit into that model? I wish we kind of could have asked him that directly. But what do you think?
I cannot answer you that question. Are you asking me? Why we're doing these interviews to actually get a more of a perspective. No, I asked the question of accountability because it is a huge, you know, we talk about the freedom of speech, which is very important for democracy. But and then some people say, yeah, the internet gave us freedom of speech, but the internet doesn't give us any accountability to what you actually speak up for.
I mean, nor any accountability for what you collect. You know, look at this Apple versus Facebook dilemma that's happening today. Did you hear about this?
No, but I have another very interesting thing for me, which came up in this conversation, right? And that is who designed the technology in the first place? And that is a thing I think which is really interesting conversation to have, because there is basically a one demographic thing which designed the technology in the first place, and now it's up to us now to broaden it to make it more inclusive.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually, I think there's that's a whole new world, and we should actually interview someone about that, because, you know, the biases that are built in by the designer, then it's propagated through the technology. But I think the wonderful thing about peer-to-peer is that it is peer-to-peer, that it is enforced person-to-person, and therefore the protocols must be transparent to all the users. And I think that's kind of the advantage of this system and the potential of this system. And then the real proof of the whole thing is how are we going to adopt it at scale, and how are we going to bring accountability to the people who don't have that, you know, the quote-unquote people, i.e. corporations, that don't have that individual identity.
Yeah, so more questions than answers. Is that
well,
so?
Isn't that the way it goes around here? Welcome to Pot of Gold.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.